Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from where? You're at some kind of financial forum?
I'm in Jupiter, Florida. I haven't seen any signs of Tiger Woods, who lives here, but I'm at a conference that's being put on by Dawson James Securities. It's for, small cap growth stocks, and there are a lot of interesting companies represented here.
What's the buzz around that conference? Have you had a chance to talk to people? What do they feel is going on?
Well, nobody's addressing things in general. Everybody's here to push their own company. I did drop in on a presentation by a company. I think the symbol was SSR, but they're in the drone business, and they're projecting huge drone growth based on American needs in Ukraine and wherever else we're getting involved in wars. So nobody ever went far wrong buying defense contractors.
Yeah, it seems now any army, if it's not equipped sufficiently with drones, they're going to just get blown off the field.
It's true. And actually, I don't remember whether it was a headline I saw today, something I read, or something I picked up at the conference, but the U.S. military has sort of shifted in the direction of drones to maintain an edge over China. They've deployed many drones for surveillance and intelligence purposes, and I guess that suggests that we're getting more asymmetrical in the way that we look at war and prepare for it.
Now, of course, the U.S. has had big drones, its predators, and so on for two decades. But it seems to be the little handheld ones. Australia making cardboard drones that are held together with rubber bands. So anybody, you know, who can make a model airplane can make one of these.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, some of the bigger ones, of course, can even carry a nuclear payload, but certainly some very sophisticated optics. So drones have definitely changed the strategic picture for geopolitics.
Also, too, for the U.S. industrial complex, they like big and expensive, but I can just imagine what they're going to charge for a cardboard drone as opposed to what the Australians charge for one. After all, the U.S. military was paying $1,200 for optically guided kinetic connecting devices, or as you would call it for $9.95 at Home Depot, a hammer.
Yep. We'll all have a digital hammer at some point.
Yeah.
But it's true that if you divert money that you might spend on an aircraft carrier into drones, that buys a heck of a lot of drones.
Or just one really big one. Again, the U.S. military loves big.
And you've got an aircraft carrier without the boat.
Exactly. Now, there was even a rumor that the South Koreans, when Kim Jong-un was getting very aggressive, they told him, we've got 10,000 small drones with a small explosive charge with facial recognition, and it's your face on it. So the next time you show your face, maybe you may not want to, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of technology that's out there. Right, you see these displays of dancing lit up drones, you know, changing shapes and color. Only you put bombs or guns on them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So,
or even worse, facial recognition software.
Exactly, and that's what the South Koreans have told the North. Scary stuff that times we live
when
in.
The sniper is targeting. When a sniper targets you, at least the person you're talking with can say, "Hey, you've got a little red dot on your forehead there. I just felt like I'd warn you." And of course, when a drone zeroes in on your face, nobody can warn you that you're being surveilled. And the last thing I want is really to have facial recognition software up there in the ionosphere tracking my, tracking my shopping.
Well, in China, they're already using facial recognition to track everybody. And if you jaywalk, you get your social points deducted and you may not be allowed to go on holiday. That's the kind of society that's shaping up there.
That's not a huge leap from these the cameras that they have at intersections that are just sort of ATMs for cities. You know, the camera takes your picture. They had me going through a signaled intersection in Boynton Beach a couple months ago, and I think it was $178 just to clear my good name.
Now, what's going on with crude? Whenever we have conflict in the Middle East, that usually sees the price of oil skyrocket. Did that happen after that horrible attack on Saturday?
Well, 2 weeks ago, before the war broke out, I had put out a chart that showed crude oil going to 117. It was then in the low 90s and coming down from the high of $95 a barrel. And I mentioned that even though I could see the technical picture pretty clearly, I couldn't imagine what would push crude to that price. And so I mentioned that perhaps there was a war in the Middle East awaiting. Little did I know. In retrospect, it seemed prescient, but I had to add to the commentary that I don't think crude's going to get there until we see physical curtailment of oil supplies. So it had a blip, a little pop, but I think it's sort of pausing there in the low to mid 90s, and it's still not a given that it's going to push up to 117, but you can bet that if and when it gets there, the whole world's going to be in some mess of trouble that we're not yet seeing or anticipating.
Yes, the oil analysts watched on business television were saying short term there isn't much demand is declining, but nobody's exploring for new oil, and that's really going to push the price up in the not too distant future.
Yeah, and when you see it that way, you know, it looks like a great game for the suppliers. Even let's say Russia only has to part with half as much of its natural gas or crude oil when the price doubles. So the higher the price goes, the less oil they have to sell, and it seems to suit the oil providers pretty well.
What's happening with the U.S. dollar?
Well, it's going up, confounding all expectations, and the policy histrionics of the Federal Reserve, or actually not histrionics. I guess they've been pretty steadfast in managing our expectations to expect tightening. But, when your interest rates are going up with the dollar also going up, it creates an incredibly powerful deflationary force. And I know we're still sort of dealing with and thinking, trying to think our way through consumer inflation, but the deflationary forces that come out of the financialized economy, the one that has nothing to do with real goods and services, it's just all a lot of bull twaddle, paper shuffling. That's a much, much bigger entity. So the strong dollar, of course, makes it more burdensome for anyone who owes money in dollars to pay back. And of course, it makes it harder for U.S. Multinationals to make profits overseas. If everything is priced higher in dollars, then our markets weaken somewhat. The demand for U.S. goods diminishes. So So the strong dollar is something nobody wants, most particularly the Fed, but it's happening anyway.
Is that one of the reasons why U.S. companies might be bringing factories back to the U.S.? They can make money at home, but they can't make money abroad because of the high dollar?
Well, that's certainly true for manufactured goods. At some point, the cost of shipping things here becomes prohibitively high, and you start globalization has helped to keep a lid on wages here in the U.S. So it's been a long, long cycle, but you can see that certain industries are returning to the U.S. because it's just cheaper to make things that can be shipped out to customers in your own backyard, so to speak.
We'll have more with Rick Ackerman right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman. Rick, with mortgage rates getting higher, are the banks becoming stingier with loans in general and are less willing to help out people who might be thinking to start a business?
You have to look at the demand side, too. I mean, there's not a lot of enthusiastic buying, first-time buying of homes with mortgage rates headed up to 8%. And I think it's one thing, people make the mistake of projecting back a generation and thinking, well, you know, people handled 5 or 6% mortgages then, but we hadn't had the experience, really, of a real estate bubble. And, of course, the bubble always has that implication of popping, a collapse at some point. So when people buy homes now, it's not with that absolute certitude we used to have that the home would increase in value. People pretty much recognize that homes are, let's say, fully priced, to put it mildly. So you take on that 7.5% mortgage with a house that you can look at and think, well, there's no way this thing is worth $700,000. So there's a couple forces acting on the housing market that have already killed it. And it's really just a question of when we get enough transactions to mark the market, not only the residential market, but the commercial markets to mark things down to reality. It hasn't happened, but it's definitely a Wile E. Coyote situation where real estate prices are sort of hanging aloft simply because there's so few transactions.
Is it a case people now only buy a home because they need a roof over their head and they're not doing it as a possible investment? A possible investment. You hope it goes up in value.
No, I don't think that situation exists right now at all. The people, if you need that roof over your head, there are only two ways to get it, three ways. You can rent, you can buy, or you can move in with kin. And the buying option is negligible. I mean, in part, it's not even just a curtailment of demand because of high mortgage rates. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the would-be sellers aren't there either because where would they move? You know, they probably, if they have mortgages at all, they're at much, much lower rates. So if they sell the house, their options are very limited. They can buy an equally overpriced house, you know, with a mortgage, but why would they want to pay cash for a home? I guess the whole idea of mortgage borrowing is that you get the appreciation of the house and the deduction for mortgage interest. But those factors just aren't working right now. People are staying put in their homes, and the ones who can't afford to buy are renting.
Now, in Canada, if it's your principal residence, you don't pay any capital gains tax on your home, but you also don't get to deduct any mortgage payments. So a little different kind of a double-edged sword on either side of the border when it comes to that point. And yet, in Canada, we're apparently short 3 million homes. And home building is decreasing because, of course, the developers are pointing out, well, with these high mortgage rates, we can't sell anything we build. So why should we build anything? Is Canada in a big pile of hooey-dooey in real estate?
Well, you know, it surprised me. I guess the fact that mortgage interest is not deductible in Canada certainly doesn't seem to restrain your home market there in Vancouver. It's not so, but because that, you know, a lot of it had to do with the overwhelming influx of money from China. I think you've hit a wall there too, I would say.
Well, Alan Mark Angel, Canada's hottest real estate agent who deals with very high-end properties, said, in the past, the Chinese never sold. They always looked at real estate as a permanent investment. He said now they're selling, and that might be to cover losses in China, where Evergrande and Country Garden, their two biggest real estate companies, and probably together the biggest real estate consortium in the world, they're both in deep financial trouble because people bought two or three empty apartments in those cities where nobody lives. So China's got a huge real estate crisis.
You can up to a point, the builders were still building because a lot of them were building for a while spec homes, sell them, but now building to rent. And that's a relatively new development where you've got these private equity players into housing huge up till fairly recently. Building homes to rent. And of course, this followed a wave of buying homes, fixing them up to rent. And some companies really got caught in a bind there. It's going to be a lot worse, really, because a lot of them bought the top of the market and they rented to tenants who aren't going to have jobs in another year. So the real estate bust is baked in the cake already. And but there's still opportunities to short it because I was looking at the shares of Toll Brothers, the big home builder, and they're off their highs, but the stock certainly hasn't collapsed. So in the 2007 and 8 episode, probably the simplest way to get short the housing bust was to short the home builders.
Rick, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
I would say the Middle East. You know, the news networks are all kind of head up. You watch the various channels, and they all give you the smoke and fire. You know, the cameraman out there will shoot anything that's billowing smoke or flames, but they don't even tell you where the flames are. You know, they just think they want to hold your eyes with the sight of this conflagration, but they keep saying over and over again, well, you know, Israel's really going to come back at Hamas pretty hard, but they may have to wait a while because Israel has to essentially put its troops through training that will allow them to conduct a kind of cleanup operation there that hasn't been done, and it may be scorched earth, so it could be a while before we see it happen, but they've already issued a warning to civilians to get the hell out of Gaza, and I think it's with the idea of doing this operation the same way the Romans would have done it, which is to level the city and then salt the ground that remains. So anything can still happen there, and Hezbollah is a wild card. It's always possible to bring Hezbollah into it in a way that could trigger off an actual nuclear war, or maybe an electromagnetic pulse war, or whatever awaits. So the stock market is loving it. Wall Street really smacks its lips every time war is in the headlines, not just because it feeds the biggest, most capital-intensive businesses in America, but it also creates fearful expectations that, as I was mentioning earlier, driving stocks higher. You know, we've got just another fraudulent rally, and I would say in the last few years there hasn't been one share bought based on some bullish idea. It's all short squeeze, and we're in a pretty good short squeeze now based on how depressed and fearful were people were going into last weekend.
Rick, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Jim, as always. Thank you for inviting me on.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website, rickackerman.com. If you have any questions for Rick or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Find us on X at How Street. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.